Japanese Literature. My name is Allison Fincher. Read Japanese Literature is a podcast about Japanese fiction and some of its best works. All the works we discuss are available in translation, so you can read along if you want, and you can find out more at readjapaneseliterature.com. Today we're talking about the literature of the 1960s, a literature of change. We'll talk about how writers took on questions about what it meant to be Japanese in the post-war era, and what was the continuing role of Japanese tradition. We're looking especially at Yukio Mishima and Kenzaburo Oe. I will definitely come back and devote at least one episode each to Mishima and Oe. They are incredibly gifted and incredibly important writers. But this first time, while we're making a broad overview of Japanese fiction, I want to talk about them as a pair. And I'll explain why in a few minutes. A quick content warning, this episode will address fascism and suicide. Japanese people in the 1950s looked into the future with a lot of optimism. In the last episode, we talked a little bit about the new constitution pushed through by the American occupation forces in 1946. The resulting constitution was one of the most progressive in the world. It granted a variety of fundamental human rights, including all the civil rights and civil liberties of the American Bill of Rights. But it went way beyond what Americans, or people almost anywhere else in the world, were guaranteed under their constitutions. Maybe most notably, Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution was a statement of profound pacifism. Aspiring sincerely to an international peace based on justice and order, the Japanese people forever renounce war as a sovereign right of the nation, and the threat or use of force as a means of settling international disputes. In order to accomplish the aim of the preceding paragraph, land, sea, and air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained. The right of belligerency of the state will not be recognized. Even though this new constitution was forced on the new government by the U.S., it was initially greeted by widespread popular support. What else made Japanese people optimistic going into the 1950s? World War II was a kind of artificial equalizer. By 1945, almost everyone's wealth had been destroyed. What hadn't been bombed or burned was eaten up by inflation. All kinds of hierarchies collapsed. Gaps between urban and rural, gaps between those with higher and basic education, gaps between those born into old money and those who weren't. It's certainly not true that Japan was ever some sort of paradise of sameness. But for about two decades, the lives of many, many people in Japan looked more alike than they had ever looked before or have ever looked since. Relative equality of opportunity for many, but not all, Japanese made people more hopeful about the future than ever before. Economically, many things were going well too. Historians call the 1950s and 60s Japan's era of high-speed growth. After World War II, much of Japan lay in ashes. By the 1950s, middle-class families could reasonably aspire to have their own three sacred regalia, like the emperor's jewels, mirror, and sword. Middle-class people's regalia were a black-and-white television, a washing machine, and a refrigerator. We'll talk more about Japan's economic growth in an upcoming episode. And if you want more details, you can find information about other history-based podcasts on the website. But the 1950s didn't pan out the way a lot of Japanese people had hoped. As I mentioned in the last episode, the occupation reversed course before it withdrew in 1952. That meant some of the leaders that contributed to the rise of fascism in Japan in the 1930s and 40s could and did return to power in the 1950s and 60s. People grew disillusioned when they saw that even a brief shining moment of relative equality of opportunity did not lead to equality of result. The have-nots in Japan never ceased being have-nots, outcasts, ethnic minorities, including Zainichi Koreans, and women. And Japan faced the same kinds of rapid cultural change that modernizing countries faced everywhere. As young workers moved to cities, they lost their connections to families and communities. All of these disappointments contributed to what has become known as the Summer of Rage. The Summer of Rage was a coming together of two events into a major turning point in modern Japanese history: the renewal of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty and the Mitsui Corporation's Miike coal mine strike. Tens of thousands of people took to the streets over the course of several months, and the protests grew so violent that President Dwight Eisenhower had to cancel a planned visit. The Summer of Rage ended with conservatives firmly in charge, but most people were tired of conflict. Japan's conservative party is counterintuitively for Americans called the Liberal Democratic Party. After the Summer of Rage, it became more center-right and became more focused on growing the economy than dealing with social or ideological issues. Progressives turned from trying to expand the rights that they'd been granted under the Constitution to protecting the ones that already existed. People who were more philosophically inclined moved to the margins. Many far-right conservatives hoped Japan might drop Article 9 altogether. They wanted Japan to become a military power once again. They hoped Japan might take on a more active role in Asia, like it had in the days of the so-called Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere of the 1930s and early 1940s. And they wanted the emperor to take on a more active and less symbolic role. Many far-left activists wanted to take the democratic reforms of the Constitution even further. They wanted more democracy, more rights for workers, even greater pacifism, which might mean loosening or breaking ties with the U.S. And they wanted less radioactivity, both weapons and nuclear power. Now, where did all of this leave Japanese literature? The post-war literary world didn't look much like the Jumbungaku, or high literature world, we talked about in the last several episodes. Just like in the European and American literary worlds, authors of the last 60 or so years in Japan don't break as easily into literary movements. Instead, a few monolithic authors tend to stand out in people's memories and sell a lot of books. In the 1960s, many of the writers who were best remembered and who garnered the most praise continued to deal with the legacy of World War II, directly or indirectly. And writers continued to face the big questions that had dogged writers in Japan since the Meiji period. What has Japan gained by modernizing, and what has it left behind? You can see these sorts of trends in the writing of other authors who emerged in the 1960s and 70s, including Kobo Abe and Shusaku Endo, and I'll devote later episodes to each of these writers. But today, we're talking about Yukio Mishima and Kinzaburo Oe. Why have I chosen to look at Mishima and Oe specifically, and as a pair? In many ways, they are opposites. Mishima's background is urban, Oe's is rural. Mishima is from the center in a lot of ways. He was born and raised in Tokyo. Oe is from the periphery. He is from Shikoku. Mishima is from a background of relative wealth. Oe is from more moderate means, though by no means poor. Mishima became a figurehead for the far right. Oe has been strongly aligned with left-wing causes. Mishima died very young, over 50 years ago. Oe, though elderly, is still very much alive. And even when they were both still alive, the two men were very much aware of each other as opposites. Literary magazines interviewed them together as opposing forces. But they were also friends of a sort. Oe, for example, was a guest at Mishima's 1964 Christmas Eve party. And they were close enough that Oe felt deeply wounded when Mishima committed suicide in 1970. Oe has spent a good bit of time analyzing Mishima's literary and political legacy, as we'll discuss. Before I get into Mishima's biography, I want to take note that Mishima's legacy is incredibly complex. Dr. Marvin Marcus at Washington University in St. Louis describes Mishima as, quote, a sort of Zen paradox, a deeply reflective writer who craved the limelight, and a boxer and bodybuilder with a powerful intellect and a penchant for self-promotion. Even more than most celebrities, almost certainly more than most authors, Mishima was involved in his own myth-making. A cynical observer could say it's almost impossible to know when Mishima was and wasn't being sincere. And today I'll be giving only a very cursory biography of Mishima. I'll come back to him in a later episode and cover his life in greater detail, including his sexuality, his preoccupation with masculinity, and his mentor Yasunari Kawabata, who deserves an episode of his own as well. The man who came to be known as Yukio Mishima was born in Tokyo in 1925. His birth name was Kimitake Hiraoka. His grandfather was a government official. His grandmother was from the samurai class, which had been dissolved after the Meiji Restoration in the 1860s. Mishima seems to have really valued this samurai family legacy. He was still in school when his teachers helped him publish his first story in a literary magazine, Bunge Bunka. It's his teachers who chose his pen name, Yukio Mishima, from the train station they passed through on a trip to the countryside that winter. While Mishima was a student at Tokyo University, he received a draft notice for the Imperial Japanese Army. You might expect that a man who spent the final 10 years of his life devoted to masculinity and the military would be happy to serve. But the day of his physical examination, he had bronchitis. He allowed the examiner to conclude, falsely, that he had pleurisy and was unfit to serve. The regiment he would have entered was dispatched to the Philippines and almost entirely mown down. Many biographers guess that his deception changed his life. A lot of his work shows a preoccupation with the beauty of an early and meaningful death. At least superficially, Mishima was a doggedly traditionalist person. For example, he insisted on using old-fashioned pre-war ways of writing kanji, or Chinese characters, even after they were revised after World War II. He took up traditional Japanese martial arts, judo and karate. He also wrote plays in the classical no tradition. On the other hand, maybe he wasn't as devoted to Japanese traditions as his reputation made him out to be. His home was built in a Spanish style, with a marble statue of Apollo in the garden. And he didn't like Japanese food. He claimed it wasn't filling enough. Mishima's writing was more or less apolitical until 1960, after the Summer of Rage. While some 21st century readers and critics dismiss Mishima as a fascist, that's something of an oversimplification. Dr. Susan Napier, who teaches at Tufts University, explains his political vision this way. Quote, "The emperor was not a particular person, but the incarnation of an unbroken tradition extending to the beginnings of Japanese history, Japanese tradition given visible form." In other words, Mishima supported the emperor system as a symbolic center of Japanese culture, not as a particular human being. Mishima didn't especially like the man who was emperor for almost Mishima's entire life, the Emperor Hirohito. Mishima was also afraid Japan's pacifism was feminizing its men. He had a really complicated relationship to his own gender, which is too much to get into today. I should also note that Mishima didn't get along well at all with contemporary right-wing politicians who qualify more easily as fascists. He openly parodied them in his work, and they didn't particularly like him. Regardless, Mishima's a man whose politics sounded good to fascists, and he was willing to undertake political violence to achieve his means. In the fall of 1968, Mishima formed an organization called the Tatenokai, or the Shield Society, Apparently, he liked to refer to it by its English initials, SS, which is, I think it's safe to say, problematic. Mishima was alarmed by student protests that year in Tokyo. His recruitment efforts yielded about 100 members, and most of them were young men from Waseda, one of Japan's most prestigious universities. Probably using Mishima's celebrity, the Shield Society soon gained permission to train with Japan's Self-Defense Forces, or SDF. The SDF is the equivalent of the Japanese military, since Japan can't have an offensive army because of its constitution. On November 25, 1970, Mishima and four Shield Society members made a planned visit to a Tokyo SDF base. They took a general hostage and demanded to address the troops on the base. Mishima gave a speech intended to inspire a coup and restore actual political power to the emperor. His words weren't well received. The soldiers' taunts have been variously translated as "kiss your ass," "dimwit," and "go screw your own mother." The plan was so obviously going to fail that many people, including his biographer John Nathan, think the whole thing was an elaborate suicide plan from the start. After the failure of his speech, Mishima returned to the office and committed seppuku, or ritual suicide by slicing open his belly, ideally followed by decapitation by another person. It was really difficult thinking of which Mishima work I wanted to discuss today. Which of his many different works best represents Mishima and its place as a right-wing political presence in 1960s Japan? I could easily have chosen Mishima's short story Patriotism, which you can find in translation by Jeffrey Sargent in the Penguin Book of Japanese Short Stories. It's a romantic and erotic piece of historical fiction about a married couple who commits seppuku when their loyalties are divided between what the state tells them to do and what they consider to be right. A more sophisticated take might come from a very recently translated novel, Beautiful Star, translated by Stephen Dodd. A family of four decides they're actually extraterrestrials, called to stop human beings from destroying themselves with nuclear weapons. Unfortunately, that novel has currently only been released in British markets. Instead, I'm going to talk about Mishima's Sea of Fertility tetralogy. Many scholars think of the four books as Mishima's magnum opus. They really capture the political spirit I'm trying to get across today. Mishima is a part of Japan's right wing because he wants to get back for Japan something he thinks has been irrevocably lost. The title for the Sea of Fertility tetralogy comes from the Latin name of a formation on the moon. It's an ironic name, of course, because nothing on the moon is fertile. The tetralogy, or sequence of four books, takes place between 1912 and 1975. That means it stretches from the dying days of the Meiji period, through the Taisho era, the rising militarization in World War II, the American occupation, the economic miracle, and slightly past the end of Mishima's own life. And I'd like to note that these novels were published serially in literary magazines, as we've discussed in a previous episode. There are only two characters who show up in all four books. One is a man named Honda Shigekuni. He begins the story as a law student and friend of the protagonist of Spring Snow, and he ends as a wealthy retired judge. The other pervasive character is a bit more complicated, both the same and not the same. That character is the same spirit, probably, reincarnated four times, or at least Honda believes so. Spring Snow is a lyrical novel about two fated lovers in the Meiji era. We meet the first incarnation of Honda's friend, Kiyoaki Matsugaye, a man so beautiful, he's cast in the mold of the classical Japanese hero of the Tale of Genji. The nouveau riche Kiyoaki falls in love with Satoko Ayakura. Satoko is from an aristocratic family that has fallen on hard times. To help bolster their finances, her family has betrothed her to an imperial prince. Kiyoaki and Satoko have an illicit relationship. Satoko becomes pregnant, After Satoko has an abortion, she vows to become a nun. Kiyowaki drags himself to the abbey through heavy snow to beg her to reconsider. He soon catches pneumonia and dies at just 20 years old. But before he dies, he tells Honda, "Just now I had a dream. I'll see you again, I know it, beneath the falls." The second novel in the sequence, Runaway Horses, takes place 20 years later. Honda is now a rising young judge. He notices a talented young man at a kendo exhibition. Later, he sees the same man performing a Shinto bathing ritual under a waterfall. He convinces himself that this young man, Isao Inuma, is Kiyowaki reincarnate. If Kiyowaki represented an artistic, ethereal, almost feminine Japanese ideal, Isao represents the opposite. You might even say Kiyowaki is a Heian Japanese courtier living in the 1910s. Isao is a samurai living in the 1930s. Isao is a member of a group Mishima admired, radical right-wing youths of the 1930s who, according to Mishima, deeply and selflessly loved their country. The young man helps plan a Showa restoration to place all government functions under the emperor's control. Incidentally, Mishima claimed to be attempting a Showa restoration the day he killed himself. But the Japan of Isao's day is more corrupt than the Japan of Kiyowaki's day. Too many people oppose restoring the emperor's real power. Isao is discovered. He and his co-conspirators are tried and convicted. Because of their youth, they escape without punishment. But Isao is not satisfied. He commits what he thinks is a justified assassination, and then he commits seppuku. He is 20 years old. In the Tetralogy's third novel, The Temple of the Dawn, Honda travels to Thailand. While he travels, he meets a young Thai princess, Chantrapta, or Ying Chan. Much to her parents' dismay, she claims to be the reincarnation of a Japanese boy. She almost immediately recognizes Honda, claims to be Isao, and begs him to take her back to Japan. He ignores her, goes back to a Japan on the cusp of declaring war against the U.S., and then manages to ignore war for the next 4 years. Several years later, Honda encounters Ying Chan in Japan at his own house party. This time, he is acting as something of a peeping Tom. He watches while she has sex with a female poet who was once a friend of Isao's. This isn't the last example of Honda spying in The Temple of the Dawn or in the Tetralogy's final novel. Critics like to treat it as a symbol of Honda's tendency to watch rather than participate in his own life. In the end, Honda's villa burns down. Ying Chan must return to Thailand, where she dies of a snake bite at, you might have guessed it, 20 years old. By the time The Decay of the Angel opens, Honda has retired. Through prudent post-war investments, he has become a millionaire. He meets an orphaned 16-year-old boy named Tora Yasunaga, who works at Shimizu Harbor. For various reasons, he becomes convinced that Toru is Kiyowaki's next incarnation. Notice that Toru is the first reincarnation that doesn't come from some kind of aristocratic or well-bred background. Honda adopts him and has to teach him manners and provide an education. Honda also tries to teach Toru cynicism. He hopes that cynicism will save the boy's life and help him live past 20. For better or worse, Honda succeeds beyond his imaginings. Toru proves to be cruel and violent. When Honda gets caught spying on couples in the park, Toru moves to have him declared senile. Eventually, Toru finds out why he's been adopted. He tries to commit suicide to spite Honda, but he only succeeds in blinding himself. When Toru lives past his 21st birthday, Honda decides he must not be Kiyowaki's reincarnation after all. Some critics have suggested instead that maybe the reincarnated spirit, or even the spirit of Japan itself, has become so much less since Kiyowaki's life that the reincarnation cycle has broken. Kiyowaki to Isao to Ying Chan to Toru is the titular angel who has decayed. Then something truly unexpected happens. Honda visits Kiyowaki's lover, Satoko, at the abbey where she has lived since the 19-teens. She claims she never knew anyone named Kiyowaki. Her words baffle Honda and call the entire tetralogy into question. Perhaps then there has been no I, Honda remarks. The tetralogy closes with a description of the abbey's gardens. The garden was empty. He had come, thought Honda, to a place that had no memories, nothing. The noontide sun flowed over the still garden. Taken as a whole, the Sea of Fertility tetralogy is, like its namesake on the moon, infertile. It comes to nothing. It is like a Zen koan that clears the mind and leads to emptiness. It's Mishima's parable about 20th century Japan as he sees it, a story of a culture in constant decline. Susan Napier suggests that Honda has discovered, like many of Mishima's heroes, quote, the past cannot reinvigorate the present, but can only make the present seem more hopeless by comparison. Mishima used the decay of the angel as a prop in the last bit of the theater of his life. He inscribed the date he resolved to die, the day he did die, on the manuscript as though he completed it that morning. In fact, he had finished the book 3 months earlier. As I've already mentioned, Kinzaburo Oe's life parallels Mishima in some meaningful ways. Nevertheless, Oe's childhood is markedly different than Mishima's Tokyo upbringing in the 1920s. Oe was born in 1925. That makes him just 10 years Mishima's junior. But in the chaos of wartime Japan, that 10 years made a massive difference. Again, Oe's life is rural rather than urban. He spent his childhood in a mountain village on Shikoku, one of the smallest of Japan's four main islands. And World War II divided his childhood. He has vivid memories of being required at school to vow to split his belly open on the emperor's behalf. But the war ended when he was only 10. In a 1965 essay, he famously recalled how he and his peers were most intrigued by the strange and somewhat disappointing fact that the emperor had spoken on the radio in a human voice, no different from any ordinary adult's. The rest of his primary school education was under the new curriculum established by occupation authorities. Oe's very first train journey was to begin studying French literature at Tokyo University when he was 18. Like Mishima, Oe was a precocious writer. He won the Akutagawa Prize, Japan's most coveted literary award, when he was just 23. In 1958, when he won, he was one of the youngest people to have ever earned that honor. That same year, he also wrote the novel we're going to discuss today, Nip the Buds, Shoot the Kids. He married his wife, Yukari, in 1960. He participated in the Summer of Rage that summer by protesting against the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty. In 1963, his first son, Hikari, was born with a severe brain injury. Many years later, Oe told an interviewer that it looked like his baby had two heads. He has described his son's birth as the most important crisis of his life. It had a huge impact on his life and writing. It's outside of the scope of today's episode, but I'll definitely come back to Oe's life and work again and focus on that profoundly important relationship. Throughout his life and career, Oe has been both a literary and political presence in Japan. For example, he has called out the imperial system as a kakuremino, a magic coat that can make the wearer invisible, that he claims allows the Japanese to ignore the meaning of war. He has criticized his fellow citizens for failing to deal with their legacy as aggressors during the Pacific War. He is an outspoken critic of atomic weapons and nuclear power, especially in the aftermath of the nuclear meltdowns in Fukushima in March of 2011. Oe was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1994, the second Japanese person ever to have that honor. In his acceptance address, Oe explained how he, seeks literary methods of attaining the universal, even though he was born and brought up in a peripheral, marginal, off-center region of the peripheral, marginal, off-center country, Japan. At 87, Oi has obviously wildly outlived Mishima, who, you'll remember, committed suicide in 1970. And living longer has allowed Oi to get the final say about Mishima's career. Oi wrote about runaway horses and its protagonists as Mishima's way of making sense of his own suicide. In 1972, Oi published The Day He Himself Shall Wipe My Tears Away. On one level, it's a damning parody of Mishima's life and beliefs. Then again, its English translator, John Nathan, also described it as the work that conveys more of Oi's essence than anything he has ever written. In an interview with British novelist Kazuo Ishiguro, Oi had this to say about Mishima. His entire life, certainly including his death by seppuku, was the kind of performance designed to present the image of an archetypal Japanese. Moreover, this image was not the kind that arises spontaneously from a Japanese mentality. It was the superficial image of a Japanese as seen from a European point of view, a fantasy. There's one more thing you should know about Kinzaburo Oi before we talk about Nip the Bud, Shoot the Kids. Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is one of his most cherished books. Oi has written and spoken about it over and over again. Even in the opening lines of his Nobel lecture, he described his childhood this way. The whole world was then engulfed by waves of horror. By reading Huckleberry Finn, I felt I was able to justify my act of going into the mountain forest at night and sleeping among the trees with a sense of security which I could never find indoors. He wasn't supposed to be reading British or American authors at the time. In case he was caught with this translated edition, his mother told him to fib and tell his teacher that Mark Twain was a German author's pen name. As a boy, Oi was fascinated by one of the most famous scenes in Huckleberry Finn. If you ever studied the book in school, I'm almost certain your teacher pointed it out. Huck is an orphan who has run away in antebellum Mississippi along with his foster mother's black slave, Jim. His conscience tells him the right thing to do is help Jim escape, but he knows society tells him the right thing to do is turn Jim in. And he's convinced he'll go to hell if he doesn't. In the end, Huck famously resolves to help Jim escape, declaring, "All right then, I'll go to hell." Even as a child, Oi was moved by a hero on the margins of society who was willing to choose hell for his own sake to do the right thing. In a lot of Oi's writing, especially his earliest writing, he is inspired by the wild settings and hero of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. That includes Nip the Bud, Shoot the Kids. Nip the Bud, Shoot the Kids opens with a group of juvenile delinquent boys from a reformatory school evacuating a Japanese city in the midst of war. The narrator, whom the author never names, doesn't ever identify the war, although it's strongly implied to be World War II. After a long journey, the boys arrive in a rural village that resembles the remote area of Shikoku where Oi grew up. The villagers lock them overnight in a temple. When they wake up, they are forced to bury a pile of animal carcasses. The animals seem to have died under unpleasant circumstances. The narrator suspects that the animals died of plague. He desperately tries to hide his fears from the younger boys. The next day, they wake up to discover they have been abandoned. The villagers ran away, fearing disease. At first, the boys are frightened to be alone, but it doesn't take them long to take over the village and make it their own. "We had possessed and controlled the village," I thought, suddenly smitten by trembling, the narrator later reflects. "We had not been cut off in the village. We had occupied it." I have heard other people compare Nip the Buds to The Lord of the Flies, which was published 4 years earlier. The novels are really opposites. In The Lord of the Flies, the boys turn out to be vicious when the adults aren't around. Without the adults, the boys in Nip the Buds are truly humane. Without the adults, they become a community of people in the margins, always favorite kinds of heroes. They bury the animals and any human bodies left behind. They take in a traumatized orphan girl their own age and ensure she eats. They feed a soldier who has defected on moral grounds. They make friends with a Korean boy who in turn teaches them to hunt for birds. They even hold a harvest festival to imbue their hunt with meaning. The entire middle third of the book is a Twain-esque celebration of the best of boyhood. It's a sort of Swiss Family Robinson, DIY boys' adventure story of these young men making a life of their own. But things go sour. The girl gets sick with the plague, and the kids don't have the skill to help. When the adults finally come back, they lock the boys up. They offer them a deal. These adults won't tell the authorities about the boys' break-ins and thefts if the boys won't tell the authorities that they were abandoned. When bribed with fresh food, the boys give in. All of them except the narrator. The novel ends with the narrator fleeing from the village, hoping he won't be caught. Nip the Buds is a sophisticated book that sustains a lot of different readings. But for our purposes today, it can also be read as a simple allegory, an allegory that shows the way Owe's beliefs are so opposite of Mishima's. Old, traditionalist Japan abandons these kids. The kids build something new and special that fits their needs. When something goes wrong, the kids welcome back the old, thinking it will save them. And in welcoming back the old, they make a terrible, terrible mistake. In the words of the narrator, they'd been fooled, really fooled. So why should we read the work of Yukio Mishima and Kenzaburo Oe? These two are geniuses. They are two of the greatest and most highly regarded writers of modern Japanese literature, both in Japan and in the rest of the world. Both were considered for the Nobel Prize in Literature, and one actually won. I hardly need to make a case for reading either of these authors, and indeed, they are some of the most widely read Japanese authors in the English-speaking world. Today, I've been reading from the work of a lot of different translators. I think it's important to honor translators by name, and I almost always do, but the Sea of Fertility Tetralogy was translated by so many different people, I've elected to recognize the work of the translators on the website exclusively today. As always, you can find those works, as well as my sources and links to purchase the books, as well as a bibliography and resources at readjapaneseliterature.com. You can buy your books through our link to bookshop.org to support the podcast. You can also support the podcast by leaving us a review on your podcast app of choice. Next time, we'll be talking about the 1980s, Japan's bubble economy, and Banana Yoshimoto. If you want to offer feedback or suggestions, tweet us at @readjapaneselit or reach out to us through the website. Thank you to the Japanese Language Twitter community and the Japanese Literature Group on Facebook. Thank you, as always, to producer Kaim, K-H-A-I-M, for today's music, @KaimMusic, and KaimMusic.com. Thank you, listener, especially for your patience. I was quarantined away from my podcasting equipment because someone in my family contracted COVID. I appreciate your patience and hope it will be rewarded later this month with an unusual number of episodes released in a row.